Now,
returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to a debate on state surveillance between former CIA and NSA Director Michael Hayden and Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz. And on the other side is journalist Glenn Greenwald and Reddit co-founder Alexei Ohanian. They argue about, be it resolved, state surveillance is a legitimate defense of our freedoms. Team opposed won the resolution with a 13% vote gain.
So, Glenn, sounds kind of convincing.
Well, I have a lot to say about that, although I'll try and make my remarks actually brief. And I understand why General Hayden wants to claim that he didn't have the capabilities to stop 9/11 because he was the head of the NSA at the time the 9/11 attacks took place, and wants to say that I didn't have the ability to stop it. But that claim, that's incredibly inflammatory to Americans and people throughout the West, that we could have stopped 9/11 or disrupted this plot had we had the NSA programs that are now being debated, has offended the leading experts on al-Qaeda in the United States, who almost always defend the United States in the war on terror. One of them, Peter Bergen, about this claim, wrote on CNN on December 30th, 2013, is it really the case that the U.S. intelligence community didn't have the dots in the lead-up to 9/11? heartily. The failure to respond to these warnings was a policy failure by the Bush administration, not an intelligence failure by the U.S. intelligence community. The other expert, Lawrence Wright, who wrote the definitive book on al-Qaeda in 2003 and won the Pulitzer Prize, similarly wrote in The New Yorker in 2014 after reviewing all of the evidence in their possession already that the reason 9/11 happened was because they had collected so much information that they had no idea what they were collecting and therefore didn't share with each other the information that could have stopped the plot. And I think that's a vital point, which is that the more indiscriminate surveillance that you do when you're collecting billions of calls a day, and that's from the Washington Post, pre-Snowden, it's throughout all of the Snowden documents that the NSA collects billions of calls every day. Their main problem right now is they collect so much that they can't even physically store it all, even though you can store gargantuan information on a small little drive. When you collect that much, it's impossible to know and to detect when somebody is plotting to attack the Boston Marathon or to blow up a plane, because they're collecting everything about all of us rather than the people that they should be keeping their eyes on.
So, Alexis, come in on that. You're the self-professed, which you are, tech expert here. I mean, are we buried in data? I mean, General Hayden's saying that's precisely the challenge. There's too much data. We have to respond to it. We have to systematize it. We have to drill down into it. Are you just saying the technology is overwhelmed by the data itself?
Yes. Yeah, this is a very, very hard problem to solve. And, I mean, the gift and the curse of all that data, aside from all the civil liberty violations, is that, yeah, there may be some signal in there, but there's a lot of noise. And it's a very hard software problem to solve. And like I said, that's still only part of it, right? Because through the efforts of this mass surveillance, we've also undermined so much of the technology that makes the internet work, that keeps us safe, every one of us safe. And so it becomes more than just a rather offensive use of surveillance on innocent civilians. It becomes much more because it threatens how the internet, the technology of how the internet works and works well.
Professor Dershowitz, come on in on this one.
Well, this intelligence is always a work in progress. Intelligence in the context of newly developing technology is always a work in progress. Mm-hmm. I think we're asking for too much right now. And that's why motive is so important. And that's why it's so important to understand that Mr. Greenwald has conceded his major argument. He had said that this is all a pretext. Now he says, I don't care about motive. But pretext is all about motive. If you're prepared to concede that the motives are good and that it's a work in progress, we have to work to make it better. Now, not Greenwald, because he says it's a pretext. And if it's a pretext, there's no use trying to make it any better. I argue that it's well-intentioned, well-motivated. There are problems of too much gathering, perhaps not gathering the right information. That's why we need to reform the FISA court. That's why we need to have a range of other changes that allow us to take this work in progress and make it fit in a nice way into our war against terrorism without diminishing civil liberties. I think we can do it. We've done it with other technologies in the past. Let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's not restrict ourselves from using our tremendous technological advantage that we worked so hard to achieve. Let's work to strike the appropriate balance.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So, Glenn, I mean, to understand your argument, can you see a policy where bulk data exists that strikes the right balance?
No. There is no bulk data means indiscriminate mass collection, keeping track of who it is that you're talking to, who's calling you, and who is emailing you. And the government, a legitimate government, has no business monitoring and surveilling entire populations who are guilty of absolutely nothing. There is this attempt to suggest that, well, there are different kinds of surveillance and you can listen to email, to telephone calls and read your emails, or you can just collect metadata. They're doing both. But when they say just metadata, there are all kinds of studies, including from a professor at Princeton, Edward Felton, who have demonstrated that collection of your metadata can actually be more invasive than reading your emails and listening to your phone calls. Imagine if you call an abortion clinic or an HIV specialist or a drug addiction hotline, or if you call someone who isn't your spouse late at night repeatedly, or you call a suicide hotline. Why should General Hayden and all of the national security state officials in your government and mine know that I'm calling those people so that they can use that however they wish? I do think that's illegitimate. What is legitimate is to have targeted, focused surveillance on people who courts have become convinced are actually guilty of some wrongdoing. It worked to keep us safe when the Soviet Union had massive intercontinental ballistic missiles pointed at every one of our major cities. It can certainly work to keep us safe from a few thousand people hiding in some caves.
Now, General Hayden, in interviews and elsewhere, you said there's a fundamental difference between collection and surveillance. And these are two different activities.
There's been massive surveillance and bulk collection, all right? But let me piggyback on a thought that Glenn put out there. He just suggested to you that the way we conducted surveillance against a slow-moving, oligarchic, technologically inferior, but incredibly dangerous nation state is the way we should protect you against the nimble, agile, fanatical, individually motivated, low threshold in terms of ability to detect threat. And my point at the beginning was, you know, doing that Soviet ICBM signal thing kept you safe then, but the new threats cannot be attacked the same way we attacked the old threats. Now, back to the metadata, where I'm going to find out who's calling their abortion clinic. I started out with facts matter. So I assume on the metadata issue, we're talking about the 215 program, about the phone records, all right? Because frankly, that's the only bulk metadata NSA has on American citizens.
But it has
Canadians,
a lot on foreign nationals too, though.
Well, we'll talk about foreign nationals.
We should talk about everyone, especially in this room, that
no,
are foreign
actually,
nationals. Not just Americans matter.
Accusations fit on a bumper sticker. The truth takes longer.
Keep going.
NSA gets from American telephone providers the billing records of American citizens. What happens to the billing records is actually really important. I didn't make this phrase up, but I'm going to use it. They're put in a lockbox. All right? They're put in a lockbox at NSA. 22 people at NSA are allowed to access that lockbox. The only thing NSA is allowed to do with that truly gajillion record data field sitting there is that when they have what's called a seed number about which they have reasonable, articulable suspicion that seed number is affiliated with Al-Qaeda. You roll up a safe house in Yemen, he's got pocket litter, it says, here's his Al-Qaeda membership card, he's got a phone you've never seen before. Gee, I wonder how this phone might be associated with any threats in the United States. So I'll be a little cartoonish about this. NSA gets to walk up to the transom and yell through the transom and say, hey, anybody here talk to this number I just found in Yemen? And then this number, say, in Buffalo goes, well, yeah, I call them about every Thursday. NSA then gets to say, okay, Buffalo number, by the way, number, not name, Buffalo number, who did you call? At which point, my description of the 215 metadata program is over. That's all NSA is allowed to do with the data. There is no data mining. There are no powerful algorithms chugging through it, trying to imagine relationships. It's, did that dirty number call someone in the United States? The last year for which NSA had full records is 2012. I'll get the 13 numbers shortly. But in 2012, NSA walked up to that transom and yelled, hey, anybody talk to this number? 288 times. Now, that still may offend you, but that's not what was described over there.
Alexis, I mean, come back on that. I mean, he's describing, in a sense, a fairly minimalist system. You and others have described something that's pretty maximalist and pretty scary. Who's
yes.
right?
Well, I mean, You could listen to the technologist about this. As a technologist, I'm telling you, yes, that metadata poses a very serious threat to us because it is simply being gobbled up, sucked up, without any concern for due process, without any concern for the Fourth Amendment in the United States, without any concern for our rights to privacy. And in aggregate, yes, it is far more surveillance than is necessary, than is required to do that job. And I think I can't help but wonder, well, who watches the watchers? At this point, we are going on what? Trust? We know plenty that we've learned now, and now the response is, oh, well, don't worry, it's okay. And I don't think that's good enough. It's not good enough, because in democracies, we rely on transparency. We rely on knowing what is going on, and for too long, we have had no knowledge of exactly what was going on. And then when we found out, well, it was not the kind of thing we wanted to be done in our name. And it was, like I said from the very start, actually making us less secure. At the end of the day, I think we all agree we want security above all. But the actions we've been taking through mass surveillance actually, in fact, make us less so.
So, Alan, you know, the middle ground between these two points is it exists. The government right now, maybe you think, is benign. But what about some government in the future?
Well,
what, you know, I mean, what happens to this capacity, not today, but tomorrow, 10 years from now, 20 years from now?
James Madison said if men or women were angels, we wouldn't need the Bill of Rights. And we need the Bill of Rights because we don't trust government. And that's why we need to impose constraints. We need to have warrant requirements. We need to limit the ability to use these warrants, to use these surveillance methods. But I think we have one big fundamental difference here. I think the other side assumes you can only surveil people who are guilty. Let me give you an example that occurs, I'm sure, right here in Toronto. It certainly occurs in London. It certainly occurs in New York. Among the new primitive technologies, we now have silent cameras on street corners. That has had a major impact on reducing street crime. Now, those cameras capture the images of innocent people, all of us, walking along the street and doing our own thing. It doesn't capture what we say, but it watches us. It's Big Brother. It's Big Brother writ small, perhaps. And it doesn't focus only on guilty, because criminals don't walk around with big C's on their head. We have to have these cameras in order to send a message to criminals that if you commit a crime, there will be a video and you will be captured. That has a big impact. So you don't have to be guilty in order to surrender a little bit of your autonomy and privacy in the interests of preventing major crimes. So we ought to understand that we live on a continuum of dangers, a continuum of rights violations. Not all rights violations are the same. Having yourself monitored, walking through Times Square is, as I said in my opening, very different from having the government intrude and listen to what you say in your bedroom. And that's the kind of debate we should have. Not have debates about innocence or guilt. Due process is very nimble and very flexible. It is the process that is due you based on the degree of intrusion compared to the degree of benefit the government gets out of it. That's the way we ought to have this debate. We ought not to end all surveillance and all intrusions. And although Mr. Greenwald keeps denying this, when you really listen closely to what he's saying, he really sounds like he's against all surveillance unless you can find a guy with the Al-Qaeda card, wearing an Al-Qaeda baseball cap, an Al-Qaeda uniform, and if you can't pinpoint him and identify him, don't you ever dare to try to find him by intruding even slightly on the privacy interests of innocent people. That's not the way government works, nor should it work that way. You know?
Understand, I really do, why Professor Dershowitz wants to attribute to me these positions that are completely laughable and ridiculous, because it's so much easier to debate people when you can pretend that they hold moronic positions that they don't actually believe. It is. It's super easy. If I believe what he just said, I would urge you to vote against me. I don't believe any of that. There is a process that has been in place from the time that the United States was telling the world that the Soviet Union is this evil empire that is the greatest threat known to man, that all presidents, Democrat and Republican alike, understood could keep America safe by following, which was going to a court before you surveil somebody and listen to their phone calls and not present definitive proof positive evidence that they're guilty of something, but enough reasonable cause so that there were safeguards over who it was being monitored and surveilled, and to have enough of an ability to then listen to see whether or not there was cause to believe they should continue to be surveilled.
Would you require a warrant for the camera that I talked about?
No, and I mean, I want to explain why. The example of, let's just put a camera on a street corner and watch what people do on the street, I think proves our point. Because invading what you do on the internet is radically and fundamentally different. The internet is not simply a place that you pass by on the street. And I think one of the reasons why around the world younger people have been so supportive of Edward Snowden and view him as a hero and have been so supportive of these disclosures is because they understand what the internet actually now is for the world, which is not simply a place that we pass by on the way to do other things. It's the place where we explore who we are as human beings. It's where we make our friends. It's where we read. It's where we think. It is everything about who we are. And to allow the internet, not a street corner, but the place of this virtual reality where we exist and grow and explore, to have all privacy removed through this collect-it-all mentality, which remember is not my phrase, it's theirs, is a kind of invasion unlike anything that has taken place. Let me just leave you with one quote from James Bamford, who is an NSA historian who has worked on these issues for a long time, who said that if you allow the NSA the ability to invade people's online activity, you are allowing them to invade people's minds, their thoughts, and their very persons. And I think we all understand the value of privacy, even though those of you who voted yes on this resolution at the beginning, I can guarantee you all put passwords on your email and social media accounts and locks on your bedroom and bathroom doors. You wouldn't want me or General Hayden or anyone else trolling through it, because as human beings, we all understand that privacy is a unique guarantee of human freedom. It's where creativity and dissent and exploration reside. And when that is gone, so too is a crucial part of human freedom.
So that's a perfect segue to now call for a video that was created especially for tonight's Monk debate. It touches on what the internet means, how surveillance impacts on it. It's brief, but it focuses on the point of accountability, which I want to come back to and get the panel to weigh in on. Ladies and gentlemen, please listen now to Edward Snowden, especially for the Monk debates.
So this is a part of what today's state surveillance looks like, but it's important to remember that it doesn't stop with phone calls. It covers your emails, it covers your text messages, your web history, every Google search you've ever made, and every plane ticket you've ever bought. The books you buy at Amazon.com, the transactions are sent in plain text where it's unencrypted, and anyone, whether it's the NSA or some other foreign intelligence service, can collect this and store it for increasing periods of time. It includes who your friends are and how you communicate with them. It shows where you go and what you want to be. It also shows people in charge of state surveillance who you love. And it shows them where these people live. Now, defenders of this kind of unconstitutional dragnet surveillance might say that there's no room for abuse because we have policies in place to address these concerns. But can policies that change with every new president, with every new Congress, with every new director of the NSA really address the threat of building inside our own country this kind of architecture of oppression? What about other countries that don't abide by our policies? Is leaving our communications insecure so that the NSA can monitor them and those of our adversaries really worth the cost? And we have to remember that policies aren't perfect. Despite policy, I, as an NSA analyst sitting at my desk, had the technical authority to wiretap anyone, from a federal judge to the President of the United States, without getting out of my chair, as long as I had a private email address. And that's not a boast.
You should answer. So that's a snippet of a special 7-minute statement that Mr. Snowden recorded for the Monk debates tonight. It's live right now on our website, www.monkdebates.com/Snowden. For those watching online, have a look. So, Alan, let me come to you on, it makes a variety, number of points there that we've covered, but a key one that I think is on the minds of this audience, which is accountability. I mean, to what degree do we have a system in place now that is powerful enough to harness this technology in the ways that you want to see it harnessed, when Edward's claiming that he can get on his computer, not even as an NSA employee, but as a contractor, and log into the president's email?
Well, first of all, I think General Hayden should answer that question, then I'd love you to come back to me, but whether or not that's true or false, that's a factual statement.
Okay, well, let's start with facts.
Oh, can you
take care of her. Oh, maybe you can spare her several moments of your consideration leading up to the final destination. Oh, the earth is calling out. I wanna learn what it's all about, but everything I read is global warming going green. I don't know what all this means, but it seems to be a little attention. Oh, it's easy to look away, but it's getting harder day by day. Everything I read, global warming going green. I don't know what all this means, but it seems to be
now for something completely different.